This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the virtual space where you and I sit down and get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, what else? Coronavirus. And what I'm going to look at are three very specific questions. What testing does, the search for a vaccine, and whether any existing drug might be useful in suppressing COVID-19 and lightening the health burden. Towards the end of January, in the last series, we did a programme on coronavirus and, after listening to the experts, this is what I concluded. Don't panic, there's no need. This isn't the big one. If there is a threat, it's probably to additional demand on health services, creating problems elsewhere. Wrong. Though the health service bit was sort of right. In the 10 weeks since then, we've all learned a lot more. You may think too much sometimes. But there are some very specific questions, the answers to which will tell us how long it will take us to beat the virus. This week, we want to look at the main three. First, I want to find out why some countries, namely Germany and South Korea, are mass testing and what difference that might make. Second, whether an existing drug might be repurposed to suppress the effects of COVID-19, save lives, and ease the pressure on the health service. Third, I'm going to get briefed on the search for a vaccine. Step inside the briefing room and we'll look at this together. Test, 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 was the message from Tedros Ghebreyesus, head of the World Health Organization, as the scale of the pandemic became apparent. Some countries seem to have done this, others, including the UK, haven't. So what difference might it make? First, I'm going to hear from South Korea, which appears to have had relatively few deaths. Dr. Jerome Kim is Director General of the International Vaccine Institute, based in Seoul.
The testing started in February after the ministry detected an outbreak of COVID-19 disease in the southern city of Daegu. The investigation revealed that there were some individuals who had developed pneumonia and whose contacts had also developed a pneumonia-like illness that was similar to what had been reported from China. People in South Korea can be tested in hospitals, which is the way it started originally, but now they've put into place a number of drive-through testing centers, and now they actually have phone booth testing centers, where the person walks into the phone booth and the healthcare provider's on the other side. And that is actually faster, potentially more convenient, and you can walk up and get the test done. So typically it takes 6 hours or so to come back. We all receive these alerts on our cell phones, and it's really a very loud and annoying alarm followed by a flash alert. And it says, case detected, go to the website for more information. You go to the website and it says, there was a positive case detected. This person was, you know, visited X and Y and was at the following marketplace between 10 o'clock and 10:15 in the morning to buy peppers, captured on CCTV. If you were in the following areas or might potentially have been exposed and develop symptoms, please let your healthcare provider know. It's to inform the public when they may be put at risk. When they activate this pandemic preparedness system, they can access things like credit card receipts. They know when your car has gone through a gate on the toll road. So they really have an idea of where you are. And, you know, this was a part of a law that was put into place after the MERS pandemic in 2015. The human rights or privacy issues were discussed and worked out in advance of this pandemic. So it's a balance, I think, between privacy and security. And you wonder if, you know, again, the discussions that should happen in democracies should be in the open, and it should be in the calm, you know, light of day, not during the heat of an epidemic when everyone's afraid and we're not making good judgments because we're under a lot of pressure. If you have a person with infection and you're watching them and it looks like they start to progress, you can give them additional supplemental care. You might put them on oxygen rather than intubating them. If you wait until the very end and you have no choice but to do one thing, which is to put them on a ventilator, you're probably not helping them. But also, you know, was there a way to intervene earlier that would have prevented them from actually needing ventilation? So the only way to catch people earlier is with extensive testing and tracking. And, you know, this is the whole idea behind flattening the curve. I mean, it may not make the epidemic go away, but it also spaces out the epidemic so that the healthcare system is not inundated by this tidal wave of sick people. And it allows you to then provide care to the people who need it.
Dr. Jerome Kim. Next to Germany, where they're currently doing around 500,000 tests a week. Philipp Zanger is head of public health for Rhineland-Palatinate. He spoke to the Briefing Room's Rosamund Jones.
The test specifications were published in late January, and within the next 2 weeks, we were ready all over Germany to do the testing. So, of course, there were many obstacles involved in terms of getting the chemicals in place and also handling that large amount of samples. But it was not that much of a struggle in the end.
What seems to be happening in many countries now is, of course, because everybody is suddenly trying to test more and more, there actually is a difficulty getting the various chemicals and other things that's required. The fact that Germany started earlier, I guess, probably means that you had fewer supply problems. Is that the case?
Yes, absolutely. And we are also now facing more problems than we had in the beginning. Materials are now out of stock.
Who are you testing now?
Any case of pneumonia would qualify for a test. And people with just signs of upper respiratory infections. The public health approach is really to do broad testing. But since we're also facing the problems of not having all that capacity, we, of course, first would start to not test those people who have no risk factors or not healthcare workers. The laboratory then notifies the regional public health department, including the name and all the details of the individual affected. And then the public health agents would go out and trace contacts the person had beginning from 48 hours before the onset of symptoms up to the beginning of the isolation. And these people, these contacts, are then classified in category 1 and category 2 contacts. So category 1 would be, for example, more than 15 minutes face-to-face contact with less than 1 meter distance.
Who's actually doing the tracking and the tracing?
That's people working in public health. Now they are overworked, but they certainly managed everything in the beginning.
So are you now recruiting for more trackers?
Yes, the government has launched initiatives. So there's one initiative that hires 1,000 people, and they will be trained to really do this tracing and swabbing and also calling the contact people every day and asking, do you have symptoms? Are you still okay? Are you writing everything in your diary? People are asked to have a diary of symptoms for 14 days and to really check if the quarantine is also kept by these people. And the whole concept that has evolved now over the last weeks is to know what's going on and to have a clear picture of the spread of the virus. And why we still even think we may want to test more is that decision makers have to have clear information about the current load of infected people, and then from there delineate whether social distancing can be loosened or whether it should be tightened again.
So this is about giving you the information that you need to know when and how to ease the lockdown.
Yes. Testing is first of all an instrument for decision makers and policy makers to lead society through probably one of the most difficult times we had since World War II.
Philippe Tsanger. We're famously way behind those countries on testing, but pretty similar to many others. What difference does this make? And should we put a lot of effort into testing everyone? Professor Devi Sridhar is from the University of Edinburgh, where she holds a personal chair in global public health. Professor Sridhar, do we know that the sort of testing that Germany and South Korea have done will reduce deaths overall in the severity of this pandemic?
I don't think we can say in the long term which country's strategy will result in the least number of deaths. I think we can say, though, in the short term, that a strategy of mass testing, tracing contacts, isolating those who are carriers of the virus, and treating all those that come forward who are ill is a good strategy. And on that metric, I think South Korea, Germany, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, these are all the countries to be looking at and learning from.
Now, there seem to be two very different sorts of ways in which tests might help. The one is that where you get, say, health workers, you need to know much more quickly whether or not they can are fit for working, because otherwise you lose too many of them. Now, the other one is you need significant data on who's had the virus and got the virus where, so that you can decide how to respond in particular areas and you can also see how it's moving. And if that's the case, what do you then do as opposed to what you do if you haven't got that information?
We're basically in a lockdown, which means everyone is assuming that they have the virus because they're, you know, trying to distance from other people. And that's kind of the advice they're getting, which is, you know, make sure you're not actually carrying it and spreading to others. But I think if we can move to a more nuanced approach, which is actually saying to individuals, well, actually, you are carrying it, or you have been exposed to it, or you might feel fine because we do have all these asymptomatic carriers, but you are a risk to others, then actually we'll have better compliance. It's important also for planning, because from, you know, onset to actually seeing someone, if they get to the sad case of dying, is about 18 days. And so you can look at your health system and say in a few weeks, given how many people are testing positive, how do we actually plan for that in terms of resource allocation to hospitals? So the other kind of test you've mentioned is an antibody test. So this tells you, have you been exposed to the virus, had an immune response, and now this is giving you some kind of immunity? And we still don't know if this immunity would be for a couple of months, or if it would be for a couple of years, or if it would be lifelong. This is an unknown question.
Now, in the UK, in the case of the first test, this is the one there's so much controversy about at the moment, because we want it, but we don't simply, for various reasons, don't seem to have enough of it. And in the second case, we don't actually yet have that test.
Yeah. I think what we need to hear is, where exactly are the bottlenecks? It seems like we've had an overly centralized response that has depended on a few labs who have capacity issues, and now they are trying to figure out how to massively scale this up and draw on other kind of private labs, university labs. But it's kind of a scramble, because these are the kind of questions on testing that, you know, Senegal and Liberia and, you know, South Korea were thinking about in January. So, of course, puts us a bit behind the curve in a way of trying to get ahead of the problem. But we need to get out of this lockdown, because it's not sustainable to keep, for a whole range of reasons, socially, economically, think of all the whole mental health issues, delayed care for non-essential surgery. These are really costly ways of dealing with an outbreak. It's kind of like a blunt policy instrument. So I think the only way to go forward is we have to kind of retrace our steps and figure out how to build this capacity. And it might take us longer than other countries, but I don't see any other way out right now.
Where's it stuck, do you think?
I do think there is truly a capacity issue. But I think equally important is the messaging. And I think if the government had been straight from the start with the public and said, we want to do this, this is how many we can do, we know it's not optimal, this is where we would like to go, this is what needs to happen, these are the ideas that we're thinking about. There's a messaging issue. There's mixed messages coming out of actually, are they actually trying to do this in a big way?
Professor Devi Sridhar. So, yes to testing. Next, is there a halfway house between now and the rollout of a vaccine. There have been a number of reports suggesting that some existing drugs might work against COVID-19. Professor Johan Neitz is Professor of Virology at the University of Leuven in Belgium. His department is actively seeking to develop such medicines. Professor Neitz, in principle, where in our existing stock are the most hopeful kinds of drugs?
What we're doing right now in my lab, and some other teams are doing that as well, we're looking into all active components of existing drugs. You know, I mean, you have drugs against headache, against high blood pressure, and we're testing in the lab if they have some beneficial effect against the virus. And then we test in animal models. Next step is then basically to design clinical studies and tests in patients.
Now, how far have you got with that already?
So we're just in the middle of that. We have all the tests ongoing. We have a fully automated high biosafety lab in which we can test a couple of thousands of components a day.
Now, with what you know of the work you're doing and what you know of the work that is being done in other countries, what do you imagine would be a realistic timetable for the establishment of some drugs which could go to mitigate the effects of coronavirus in patients?
Well, the good thing is that we know that some of these studies have started quite some weeks ago in China. The plan was to have something like 700 to 800 patients enrolled in that study, and I'm pretty sure that the data should come out in just a couple of weeks from now. Also, studies are ongoing with an Ebola compound in the United States and another compound, a molecule against malaria, chloroquine, is also being tested in clinical studies. And so the good thing is that because these are known medications, as soon as a study shows a benefit in patients, it could then basically start using that all around the world to treat patients with this compound.
So we could be talking maybe 2-3 months before we have any significant rollout anywhere of anything.
Yeah, I hope it could be shorter, but that may be the timeline that we're looking at.
That's good news. Could we have done all this earlier?
Yes. Now, the question is, why don't we have it? And the reason is that, as virologists, we're always saying, I mean, be careful, these coronaviruses, they can yield nasty bugs. But somehow, mankind did not listen to the message of virologists. And we knew, of course, that this family of coronaviruses could yield bad pathogens, because we have seen it in 2003 with the SARS coronavirus in Hong Kong. And the other wake-up call was in 2012 with the MERS coronavirus, which is circulating mainly in the Middle East, but they also had an outbreak of it in South Korea. And still, there was not much enthusiasm to basically start a program on coronaviruses. Now, the point is, I think this is the last wake-up call. It shouldn't happen again. We can, in peacetime, do good research and basically develop highly potent and highly safe antiviral drugs. It's sort of a shame. I mean, if you see countries are investing a lot in defense and fighter planes, and this is for people to fight people and to protect against people. But they all forgot that we have this joint enemy, viruses. And we all forgot that we should sort of weaponize ourselves against these viruses. And if you see now the misery, the human suffering today of having done nothing against coronaviruses, that's really, I mean, I'm pretty sad about that. And if you also see the economic impact of it, then an investment of a couple of hundred millions to have something on the shelf that you could deploy right away if you discover new pathogens, that would have made a big difference.
Professor Johan Neitz. Finally, the vaccine, the magic bullet that kills corona. But how far are we from finding one? Professor Adrian Hill is the director of the Jenner Institute at Oxford University. Professor Hill, where are we with a vaccine right now?
There are about 50 groups around the world, I'm told, beginning or trying to make a vaccine against COVID-19. Two of those groups have started clinical trials already in record time. Other groups will do that in the next few weeks and months. And a whole variety of different vaccine technologies and approaches are being tested, trying to do something that's never been done before, actually design a vaccine, bring it through to manufacturing, then into a clinical trial, and then find out whether it works in a matter of months rather than years.
Now, why might we be able to develop a vaccine more quickly than the 10 years, which is usually given as the time frame?
might be a more straightforward vaccine to make. Vaccines have been made to some extent against other coronaviruses already. We've been involved in one against MERS, which is prevalent in Saudi Arabia. There are many groups trying, of course, which improves the chances. The committees and authorities that give permission for clinical trials are helping out at record speed to give approvals, etc. In our university, we're lucky to have our own small manufacturing facility, which let us start manufacturing as soon as the vaccine was ready, and that has been manufactured, ready to start a clinical trial in a few weeks. But generally, there's been a huge amount of support from other people downing tools on what they're doing and joining the clinical team for the COVID vaccine trial.
And when will you start clinical trials on human beings?
Well, we're targeting the end of April, maybe 22nd, 23rd, 24th. What's more important, really, is when we can finish, and we're targeting around about the end of July, not only to have tested the safety of the vaccine, but whether it's actually efficacious. And the big challenge there is that most people expect, we hope, that the pandemic will have died down a bit by late summer. So we really have to try and do the trial now or in the next couple of months while there are a lot of cases around to find out if the vaccine works.
Now, clinical trials accelerated, then you've got to get the approval, and then you've got to get the thing manufactured. Now, assuming that that's all at an accelerated timetable too, what could we realistically be talking about?
So you've mentioned the things we've been able to do. We haven't discussed what is really the biggest challenge. What we've never done is try to manufacture a vaccine at huge scale so that we can impact on a pandemic very quickly. And that's our biggest challenge today. So we're trying to do that at the moment, but of course that costs a lot of money, and we're trying to persuade people to take the risk to invest now so that if we are successful in July or August or whenever, then there's vaccine available rather than just knowing that the vaccine works.
I'm sorry, who do you have to persuade to do that?
Well, we're trying many sources. So governments, principally, might want to protect their own population. We're talking to various governmental funders. There are philanthropies. There's a specific funding agency that works out of London called CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. They've been given hundreds of millions of pounds, some of that by the British government, specifically to address vaccines for this type of outbreak and epidemic. So they are funding us. We would like them to support some of those manufacturing costs, which are very, very substantial.
Sorry, why haven't they just already said yes to that?
Ah, because they luckily are spoiled by choice. There's not just ourselves running in this race. There are dozens of other candidates. There are probably four or five really plausible ones that might be in the clinic by the end of the year and might be able to impact on the epidemic, and they have to choose.
What is the role of major pharmaceutical companies in all this?
First of all, there are only five of them that do vaccines on a grand scale. Three of those helped out enormously 5 years ago during the Ebola outbreak. They all lost money, but we have seen just in the last few weeks a lot of very encouraging signs that pharma realize that they really should be involved and are beginning to do quite a lot.
Sorry, that's a should be, not that they will profit from being, but that they should.
Correct. I think most of them are doing this with a humanitarian objective very much in view. And I think what really needs to happen here is pharma to bring in their experience and capacity in large-scale manufacturing and late-stage clinical development and to link up with maybe biotechs or academic groups who are often more nimble and many of whom are already getting close to the clinic with new technologies that might be very suitable for an emergency response, to create those partnerships that can really move quickly. They're going to have to be very large-scale manufacturers producing millions of doses per week, and even that may not be enough. You may need tens or hundreds of millions in a very short period of time. And frankly, the world hasn't done that before.
Professor Adrian Hill. And I put some of those points to Professor Devi Sridhar, who you heard earlier. Professor Sridhar, how much hope do you think we should put in a vaccine anytime really soon?
I think it's unrealistic to have a vaccine before a year's time. We've never seen science so fast. So that's really optimistic. That's really hopeful. But then we have all the steps that need to take place next. what kind of dosage do you need? Do you need one dose or two or three? And what about elderly and those who are immunocompromised? Is the vaccine safe for them? What about pregnant women? And so I think there's a lot to be done in terms of seeing if it's effective and is it safe? What does this mean for rich countries, for poor countries? How are we going to allocate and prioritize? I mean, that's going to be, I think, the next stage of the debate once we have it.
Well, that would seem intolerable, wouldn't it? I mean, the idea that you could develop this thing, that you have it available, but that somehow, for whatever reason, everybody who needs it can't get it. And presumably, we're not just talking about developed countries here. We're talking about the need for vaccine in less developed countries. How can we make sure that everybody who needs it gets it?
Well, I think here is where you actually need institutions like the World Health Organization, you know, the WHO, because you need someone who's basically a neutral arbiter between countries to discuss these really difficult issues. And in the past, for Ebola, who got treatment for ZMapp when it was extremely limited, but it seemed to be very effective? It depended if you were a citizen of Europe or the States. If you were a citizen of Liberia, you would not get it. So that's how we've dealt with it in the past. And I think what we're trying to do is learn from those experiences to say, how do we do this differently? And how can the WHO bring the different partners to the table? Because unfortunately, what you'll probably see is a scramble. And you've already seen this with, you know, the United States and, you know, President Trump there trying to, you know, buy a company from Germany to get the vaccine, saying it's exclusive to the States. You're going to see a lot of this happening. And so you do need these kind of international institutions, because you need to have some kind of guiding ethical and equitable principles guiding this. And one might be actually, does it go to low-income countries who have the, you know, least infrastructure for medical care? If you have a country with a few ventilators and no trained staff, this will be absolutely dreadful in terms of how it spreads. So would you go for those populations first because they're more vulnerable? Or are you going to go for who can pay the most? Or is it going to go to the Security Council and you're going to have, you know, the powerful states decide there how they're going to do it? Is it going to be based on geopolitical interests? I don't know how it's going to play out, but this, I think, is going to be a huge question once the vaccine is produced, because this is going to lead to massive destabilization and, you know, threats to peace and security across the world.
Looking at the question of what the pandemic teaches us about public health, what do you think the big lessons we're going to need to learn in countries like the UK are?
Well, I think there's two. So the first one is how interconnected our world is, and that if something is happening in Mali, it's quite likely that would affect your life in a couple of weeks if that virus or that pathogen or whatever is happening there is able to transmit easily. We might think of ourselves as being, you know, British citizens or American citizens or South African or, you know, Indian. But actually, in the end, we're all human and we're facing a common challenge. The second thing would be the importance of prevention and overreacting. You know, when I was talking about this virus in January with friends, because I was starting to worry from about kind of second, third of January. And the reaction I got, you're overreacting, you're spreading panic. Is it really that bad? And so I think it's the lesson that it's better to overreact. It's better to be South Korea than to be in the position, I guess, that we're in right now. And so we should always take the precautionary principle. Part of public health is overreacting, hopefully preventing something from happening. And then afterwards, everyone blames you for overreacting because nothing happened.
Better to be blamed for overreacting than discovering that you've got a pandemic loose which overturns the world order.
Exactly.
Professor Devi Sridhar. My conclusion, for what it's worth, if we do the right things, we will get there, and quite quickly. Then we have to make sure that everyone gets the drugs they need, and after that, do what's necessary for this not to happen again. My thanks to Jerome Kim, Philip Tsanger, Devi Sridhar, Johan Nates, and Adrian Hill. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Darren Graham and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Never Missarian. And the editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including ones on the environmental cost of meat eating, whether measles vaccination should be mandatory, and the problem of antibiotic resistance. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
and all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.